Welcome to Fresh Take, where we at Florida Organic Growers speak to food systems experts about topics related to organic and sustainable agriculture, healthy lifestyles, and the environment. To help us continue our programs at FOG, including our podcast, consider becoming a sponsor. For more information on sponsorship, check out our Get Involved page on our website, www.foginfo.org.
Welcome, everyone, to our latest Fresh Take episode. Today, we're very fortunate to be talking to Dr. Carlene Chase. Dr. Chase is an associate professor at the Horticultural Science Department at the University of Florida. I've known Dr. Chase for, you know, many years, so I'm always very happy to talk to her. Today, we're going to be talking a little bit about her work and, you know, weed management, because everybody that is a farmer, or even those of you that, you know, are hobbyist farmers and gardeners, have to deal with weeds. But of course, she does a lot of work also with cover crops, and she does some really interesting, you know, research that she's going to talk to us about for those people that are interested in becoming farmers. You know, we'll talk a little bit about our Southeast Organic Transition Partnership Program, and a lot of very useful information that I'm sure that some of you are going to be using. Thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Chase.
No problem at all. It's really my pleasure.
So, of course, like I was saying, you know, we've known each other for, you know, a long time, it feels. but would you mind sharing with us a little bit about your, you know, sort of background experience, and maybe, because maybe that's not something I've ever asked you before, is how was it that you got interested in, you know, ag and sort of went down the path that you took?
Well, you can hear from my accent that I am originally from the Caribbean, right?
Yes.
So I am from Trinidad and Tobago, and I did a Bachelor of Science degree in agriculture there. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I ended up in agriculture really was because in high school, I had initially thought I'd do languages and have a job like be an interpreter or something, because I really enjoyed Spanish and French. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we have this British system where we do what is called like O levels, and then you have another 2 years of sort of pre-university preparation that's called advanced level. Mm-hmm. And at advanced level, I sort of decided, you know what? You know, I really enjoyed my biology class. Uh-huh. And I was really wanting to shift to science instead.
Yeah. Yeah.
So during A-levels, I initiated that shift, but still didn't have enough of those science subjects to apply to the University of the West Indies for mm-hmm. a natural sciences degree. Mm-hmm. And I had a family friend who said that there's a pre-agriculture course for a year that you can do chemistry and biology uh-huh. and get into natural sciences. Uh-huh. But while doing that, you know, I was exposed to students and faculty uh-huh. in agriculture and sort of, you know, got swayed to stay in agriculture mm-hmm. and thinking that it would be a really exciting opportunity to combine doing science with being outdoors.
Yes.
And so I decided to continue on to get an undergraduate degree in general agriculture. And, you know, just while doing that, you know, somebody else, you know, one of the senior students said, so what are you going to do when you're finished? Have you thought about that? Mm-hmm. And that, you know, so sort of my second year, I started to think, I really enjoy doing, you know, being at school. And I thought that I wanted to sort of focus on sort of vegetable crop production. And so that sort of encouraged me to focus on horticultural sciences yeah. when I went on to grad school. So that's really my story. I kind of stumbled into it because I grew more and more interested in science.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's so interesting that, of course, like I was saying, I didn't know that about you. But like you, and it almost sounds like you also did not grow up in a farm, right? There was no one maybe involved in farming when you were growing up?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
My father was a journalist uh-huh. and my mom, you know, just worked in the post office. Mm-hmm. But she liked to garden. Uh-huh. And I was the only one in the family that would be interested in gardening with her.
Okay.
So, in addition to having a few plants in the front yard to make the front yard look nice, she would spend a little bit of time gardening on the side of the house and putting in, things that we could use in the kitchen.
And so, like I was saying, because I also did not grow up in a farm, did not really become interested in ag or even consider, getting a degree in agriculture until much later. But like you was also interested in maybe perhaps teaching, English as a second language. That was actually my first job out of high school. Was lucky to sort of apply for a job at one of the local English institutes, and so that's how it started. But somehow through that became really sort of just in love with teaching, and then just doing that sort of thing. But so that's interesting how that life works sometimes. So you end up obviously getting your degree, and somehow at some point end up here at the University of Florida, correct? Did you get your master's and PhD at UF?
So I got my master's in Canada at the University of Guelph, in horticultural sciences. And while that was funded by a Canadian Commonwealth Fellowship, and I received a letter one time before I was finished saying, if you want to go on for your PhD, you need to inform the Ministry of Agriculture by a certain time. And so that was like, oh, I could go on to do a PhD. And so I applied to University of Florida, which was one of the places I had applied initially to do my master's. But when I got the fellowship to go to Canada, I had funding, so I went there instead.
Of course.
But going to the University of Florida would, I thought, would give me more opportunity to work on crops that were more pertinent to the Caribbean, because I had planned to return there when I was finished. And so I did my PhD in weed science. But as you know, Florida does not have a weed science department.
Yes.
And so I did it in the horticultural sciences department. So my PhD is in horticultural sciences, in horticultural science, but the emphasis was fully on weed science.
Correct. So you complete your PhD, you're now, a wheat scientist specialist, and many people, including myself, often, come to you when we have questions about, weed management, or sometimes even just, identifying specific weeds and what to do. Would you mind sharing with us a little bit about, your current research? Because you, besides, weeds, and weed management, you also, work quite a bit with cover crops, right?
Yes, so but the reason why I work with cover crops is primarily because I want to use them to suppress weeds.
Correct. Okay.
So it's still an aspect of weed science. So I kind of stumbled into this really because my training was really on biochemistry and physiology of understanding herbicide resistance. The focus of the weed that I worked on was it was American black nightshade.
Okay.
But as I was establishing my career at UF, really weed science research for a long time, since I would say the 1940s, when herbicides started to become commercially available, was funded by chemical companies. And just as I was establishing my career, they were going through this sort of, a lot of them were sort of taking over each other. And so we ended up with many fewer chemical companies, just like, maybe four or five. And they were doing less herbicide development. So there was less funding available from those companies for research. And so at that same time, I was mentored by a weed scientist in my department who is now retired, Bill Stahl. And he had been serving as a co-PI on a grant with another retired scientist, Waldy Klassen, who had been in the Tropical Research and Education Center, and they'd obtained a grant to utilize sun hemp, cowpea, and velvet bean as cover crops for weed management in Florida cropping systems during the summer off season. And so that is how I got interested, because Bill was primarily the type of weed scientist that focused on herbicides, and he was like, oh, here's the new young person joining the department,
Yeah.
and that. And really, I was able to sort of establish a foothold with preliminary data from that and utilize that to get other grants that involves utilizing cover crops for weed management.
Okay.
That was kind of the springboard for that.
Yeah.
A curious element of the story at the same time was Florida Organic Growers was actually having a series of workshops across the state where they were exposing UF researchers to the fact that, organic growers were underserved in terms of research at the University of Florida, and sort of, informing us about opportunities that we might want to consider.
Yes.
And so that was also, part of the, incentive for continuing to do research that would serve the needs of organic growers in terms of managing weeds in their cropping system.
Yeah. That's pretty neat because again, FOG, our role in the state and now through the transition to organic partnership program that I mentioned earlier, TOPP in the Southeast, we are, looking to provide technical assistance, support, information to those farmers in the region. And it covers seven states: Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Louisiana, and Mississippi, and two U.S. territories, Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. So they can get that assistance that is much needed often, as you, I think, were alluding to, is that often many farmers may not have sort of the knowledge, the know-how, but even when it comes to all of the great research that the universities are conducting, how to do this, in compliance with the organic regulations. So I know that you've been involved quite a bit, again, with sort of adopting some of those organic practices, including in the research units at the University of Florida. There's a research unit that is certified organic where you conduct a lot of this research. In your opinion, what would you say are some of the biggest sort of challenges that both either organic or farmers are currently facing?
Some of those would include things like, cost and availability of inputs.
Yes.
Like I know in just, the end of sort of the pandemic years, the cost of fertilizer, for instance, has increased tremendously and really affected conventional growers in particular. And they are also experiencing things like herbicide resistance. They've kind of adopted, glyphosate-tolerant crops. And, using glyphosate is cheap and easy. And so they've tended to overuse it and are now having lots of problems with herbicide-resistant crops, weeds, that is. And in terms of other things, labor is a really big issue
Of course.
now,
Yeah.
particularly in, vegetable crops, which are often, hand harvested, and a lot of hand labor is needed. And that's going to also affect organic crops as well, because there are lots of operations that are done that require maybe more labor than in conventional crops.
Yeah.
And we're also seeing competition for specialty crops in both, California and Florida. Are seeing cheap imports coming up from Mexico, and that are sort of undercutting, crop production in the US because their labor costs are much, much lower.
Yeah.
And then we're seeing effects of climate change. So we're having storms that are affecting crops, like our citrus yield was really down a lot this year because of, Hurricane Ian. We're seeing droughts, and, people don't necessarily have, the same amount of, water available to irrigate their crops adequately. And so those are some of the kinds of things I think that are really affecting farmers right now.
Right. Yeah. So, but and in terms of your, of course, again, as a weed scientist, and then As you mentioned, someone who is, you know, doing a lot of work with cover crops as it pertains to also, you know, that those strategies of weed management. Can you maybe share with us a little bit about, you know, some of the results of your research and how you perhaps, you know, the organic farming practices that are part of that address some of these, you know, some of these problems? You know, you talked a little bit about climate change, and then of course, just when it pertains to weeds, how really do you think viable is for farmers to be, you know, using cover crops and some of these strategies and staying away, you know, from the synthetic herbicides that are typically used, you know, in conventional farms?
Well, curiously, even in conventional farms, using cover crops for weed suppression is actually paying off. I
Oh,
was
great.
pretty surprised that, at the recent Weed Science Society of America, how many presentations there were on cover crops. And this is, traditionally a conference where people are talking about herbicides or herbicide-resistant crops all the time. And so what they're finding is that by utilizing an off-season cover crop, that is helping them suppress a lot of the herbicide-resistant weeds and making it easier for them
Right.
to control those weeds with the alternative, herbicides other than, the glyphosate or whatever that the weeds are resistant to. So that has been very encouraging to me. But also, I mean, in terms of my own work, and you're asking about, how some of the results of my own work
Yes.
has paid off. One of the things that I'm focusing on when I'm using off-season cover crops is that I am trying to prevent weeds from proliferating in that off-season. And in Florida, primarily that's the summer time, when it's just too hot and too many pests, weeds, and diseases. And so farmers tend to just have a weedy fallow.
Yes.
And we're trying to encourage them, instead of having a weedy fallow, either as an organic farmer or a conventional farmer, if you go in and plant a cover crop that is able to germinate quickly and close the canopy quickly, produce a lot of biomass, then you can suppress weed growth and growth considerably. And we have very often what's called a legacy effect, because going into the fall, you're still planting fairly warm season cash crops in Florida. And we often see a benefit of that summer weed suppression in that early weed emergence is much reduced in the cash crop
Okay.
by having used the summer cover crop.
Okay. Okay. And in terms of those specific cover crops, and I know because you mentioned, and knowing a little bit about your research, you mentioned that you have been working with sun hemp and a few other cover crops. Are there, I'm assuming, you know, obvious perhaps differences between using one cover crop or another?
Yes. So one of the reasons why we have really liked sun hemp as a cover crop is, we're always looking for reasons to convince growers why they should use cover crops. And sun hemp, in addition to producing a large amount of biomass and effectively suppressing weeds during the cover cropping season, it also does an excellent job of suppressing nematodes that are very detrimental to vegetable and strawberry production in Florida.
Yes.
So, we've examined various germplasm lines of sun hemp and see that consistently sun hemp does a good job of suppressing root knot nematodes, and they will also suppress sting nematodes. So there it's a very good crop to plant in the summertime in advance of either strawberries or fall vegetables.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's a great tip, and for the farmers listening, that, you know, perhaps it's something you can consider when it comes to other practices. You know, we're talking a little bit about cover crops right now and planting cover crops. What are some of the other strategies that you've seen can work well, both for, you know, organic or, you know, conventional farmers, or those farmers maybe looking to, you know, move into more organic practices?
So one of the interesting pieces of work that we're doing right now, and it's primarily focused on conventional corn, soybean, no-till rotation, is planting green. And I don't know if you're familiar with that terminology, but that is when they use a rye cover crop. They would be planted in the fall and they'd let it grow through the winter and go ahead and terminate that cover crop. And typically growers would terminate that cover crop anywhere about 3 to 4 weeks before they planted the corn for their soybeans.
Okay.
But what that does is it means it limits the benefits that you get in terms of biomass production that you get from the rye and opportunities to suppress weeds and all the other benefits. And so one of the things that they've noticed is if they can wait until after they actually plant the corn to terminate the rye.
I see.
And that's called planting green because you're planting into the green cover crop.
Okay.
And there we're seeing in soybeans, there are like almost no downside of doing that.
Okay.
But in corn, they are seeing a few issues in terms of, you know, a reduction in yield. And so some of our research is trying to figure out what's causing the yield reduction. But that is a system that could be readily utilized by organic growers.
Yes.
Because they can very readily terminate or kill a rye cover crop using roller crimping.
Okay.
So, and then they would have that benefit as long as they had a planter that could easily plant into the, you know, that biomass of the rolled rye, then they would, in addition to having the additional biomass between, you know, with not having terminated 3 weeks later, you'd have better weed suppression, and you would have a mulch to help you suppress weeds into that cash crop.
Wow.
Yeah, so we're really excited about the results that we're seeing with that. It's part of a big multi-state project that we have ongoing.
Excellent. And I had not heard about, you know, planting green. So thank you so much for, because I'm already excited and hearing you explain this. And do you know if there's any other work being done? You mentioned that this is being done with corn and soybeans. Is there anyone, or are there any, you know, places where it's being tested with other crops, like, you know, vegetables as well?
So vegetables are always a little bit tricky with utilizing mulches.
Yes.
And I myself have been trying, I have a project with Calabasa, actually, where we're looking at utilizing Calabasa as an emerging new crop for Florida.
Okay.
And so I've been evaluating several germplasm lines, and Dr. Meru and has been looking at conventional systems, and I've been looking at hopefully using rye prior to spring planting of Calabasa. But I think we haven't had very good results because the mulch has not been persisting sufficiently long. And so we've had problems with the weeds coming up through the mulch, and then the difficulty of weeding, you know, in terms of utilizing any kinds of cultivators, any kind of cultivating practices with the remnants of the mulch. And curiously, when we decided, well, you know, rye, I used Renzabruzzi rye because Florida 4-1 was not available. I think we would have better results with Florida 4-1 because it produces much more biomass, so that the mulch would probably persist and be a more effective suppressor, but that's not been available. So I thought I'd try sorghum Sudan grass for fall production.
Okay.
And we obtained quite a lot of biomass that did much better weed suppression. But curiously, I determined that it is very difficult to kill sorghum Sudan grass with roller crimping. Because it just tillers. It continues to tiller from, you know, underground stems.
And then that is also by, you know, having conversations with you in the past, is that, you know, once you plant that cover crop, that's another consideration, if I'm not mistaken, is, you know, how are you going to either till that cover crop in, or once or before you plant your, you know, your next crop, how exactly you're going to be able to do that depending on the type of cover crops? Because I'm sure that you can share with us so a lot of information and tips of, you know, what works, what doesn't work. And I also know that besides some of the things that, you know, we're discussing, cover crops also in some cases, I think sun hemp, it might be one of those, attracts, you know, pollinators and some of the other maybe beneficial insects to your farm. Is that correct?
Yes, so that is quite true. I mean, if you think of something like cowpeas, cowpeas are very good for pollinators because not only do they produce flowers that can attract all sorts of beneficials, but they also have these nectaries that are on the stems of the plant that also produce nectar that that attract beneficials. So, you know, quite a few of the broadleaf cover crops will produce flowers. And since they're typically not going to be terminated until about 50% flowering, you can get some benefit of them serving as not just, you know, as food sources for pollinators, but also cover crops could be really important for just for providing habitat for beneficial organisms.
Dr. Chase, I feel like I can talk to you about weeds and cover crops all day. And so, but one of the things that maybe perhaps you can share with us is how farmers and people who, you know, are considering either starting their farms or implementing some of these tips you've given us, how they can find out a little bit about more about your research and perhaps any sort of additional tips, information. I know that you've been talking to me a little bit about some tools. You're also looking to recruit some farmers for some of these projects. Can you tell us a little bit about that, you know, that other things that, you know, you've shared with me in the past?
Yes. So one of the things that I've been really been involved with regarding outreach about cover crops and trying to encourage farmers to adopt cover crops has been my work with being a founding board member of the Southern Cover Crops Council. And so one of the things that we've been really involved in recently has been to focus on developing a cover crop decision support tool. And this involves, you know, being able to utilize a web tool that will allow you to select cover crops that are appropriate for your farm and for the particular objectives that you might have. And it initially started with the Midwest Cover Crop Council having such a tool. The Northeast Cover Crop Council developed one as well. And we are the most recent one of the councils to develop our tool. So this tool is currently being evaluated by farmers. And with the idea that we would finish evaluation around November and be able to make some adjustments of the tool based on the feedback of the evaluators and to have a soft launch of the tool in January of 2024. And so that, you know, when a farmer is interested in finding a recommendation for cover crops to be used on their farm, they can just go ahead and, you know, click on this tool and provide information about their farm and get specific recommendations for particular cover crops for the appropriate season and for the appropriate objective, whether that's weed suppression or whether that is to try to increase organic matter or, you know, to improve soil health, those kinds of objectives.
Sure.
We also have at the website, you know, fact sheets that people can access about cover crops. And so I encourage folks to just search for Southern Cover Crops Council, and there are going to be increasing availability of decision support tools over the next few years.
Yeah. Well, Thank you so much again for talking to us today. You provided, you know, some really useful information and tips and to all of the organic farmers and transitional farmers and conventional farmers listening out there. You know, I encourage you to follow Dr. Chase's, you know, research more closely. I think you can find information on the Horticultural Sciences Department at the University of Florida website, where you can see a lot of the work that's being done that Dr. Chase is currently involved in. We really appreciate talking to you today, Dr. Chase.
Oh, it was my pleasure. You know, and folks can feel free to reach out to me. I know Juan Carlos ever so often would refer a farmer
That's
to
right.
me.
That's right.
Yeah, and so I'm happy to accept calls.
Yes.
Or emails, if you have specific questions of that, you know, in regards to cover crops in general or weed management
yes.
for cover crops in particular.
Yeah, that is correct. And we certainly appreciate, Dr. Chase, what you've done, you know, to support FOG over the years and our farmers. She's always very, very, you know, readily available to answers, you know, farmers' questions about weed management and cover crops. We really appreciate your time today. And to everybody listening, tune in next time where we will be sharing more information that we hope can benefit, you know, organic farmers, people considering transition, and gardeners in general. Thank you so much for joining us today.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Florida Organic Growers is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. So to keep our content available and free to the public, we need your help. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen, and consider making a tax-deductible donation or become a sponsor. Learn more about our work and how you can become a sponsor from our website, www.foginfo.org.